Welcome to the Awakening Shalom Podcast. The Awakening Shalom Podcast is an opportunity for digital faith formation at Myers Park Baptist Church that accompanies the Awakening Series, a year-long journey of exploration and discernment which invites all people to come learn about the current social justice issues of the day and how they impact our faith. What we are awakening to is shalom, the Hebrew word for the peace and beauty that exists when we are living in right relationship with God, ourselves, other human beings, and all created things. Today, we are incredibly excited to host scholar Brian Bantam, who is professor of theology at Seattle Pacific University. Dr. Bantam earned his PhD at Duke University, and his teaching and research focus on the intersection of theology and identity, exploring how Christian claims are illuminated and challenged by the realities of race, ethnicity, and gender, which, by the way, we all carry on our bodies. Brian was one of the teaching assistants while I was at Duke, and I benefited greatly from his instruction, and I know we all will today. Dr. Bantam is the author of numerous articles and two books. His first book, Redeeming Mulatto, A Theology of Race and Christian Hybridity, explores how mixed race identity shapes and reimagines Christian discipleship. His second book, The Death of Race, Building a New Christianity in a Racial World, looks like this, and offers the church ways of reimagining Christianity in light of modern race theory. The Death of Race is available for purchase today in the Heaton Hall foyer right outside here. Dr. Bantam is also married to Reverend Gail Song, who is executive pastor at Quest Church in Seattle, and he is father to three children. After this forum today, Dr. Bantam will preach in worship, and then he will lead a special winter session of sermon talkback right back here in Heaton Hall. Lunch will be provided, and even if you didn't register, you are welcome to come back here and join us for that special session of talkback. Dr. Bantam's title for this morning's seminar is This Is My Body, Why the Body Matters in Christian Discipleship and in the Christian Life. Will you join me in welcoming Dr. Bantam to Myers Park Baptist Church?
Good morning, everyone. How are you all today? So good. It's so good to be back in smelling Carolina air. I love the Pacific Northwest, and we've acclimated well there. We lived there for about 9 years now, and but we were in Durham for about 10. And so there's just something about North Carolina that's kind of in my bones now. And so it's really, really good to be with you. And I want to thank so much Reverend Boswell for the kind invitation to be with you all this morning. And I'm looking forward to this morning and to preaching as well. So I want to begin us to help us think a little bit about the question of the body, of what it means to say that being made in the image of God is somehow that our bodies are actually intrinsic to that image. But as I do so, I also want us to begin to think a little bit about what is the significance of difference in the midst of our bodied lives. So to say that we live in a world saturated by difference is to say almost nothing at all, really. Difference is everything from distinction between color, fruit, vegetables, to the mere fact that I am not you and you are not me. And in our current moment, we feel these differences in increasingly abrasive ways. Political affiliations, race, gender, regions, theologies, we could go on and on. And far from any hope of unity, we could say that we are only seeing difference fissure with every new fragment, becoming five more when it falls off and hits the floor. In the midst of these seemingly perpetual differentiations, I realize that we might be tempted to reach back for a time when there was a sense of coherence, a sense of unity, perhaps when we thought we could agree on whatever you fill in the blank meant. But being encountered by something new tends to provoke this sort of question, this sort of response. We either embrace it or we push it away. And I remember one of these moments for me when I was in college. I'd been introduced to an incredible woman, and she was long distance, and so we were talking on the phone, we were writing letters, so this was before cell phones and email, so we had like literally stamped, so we had like two conversations kind of going back and forth, and within like 6 months, we were deeply in love, and somehow the question of women in ministry came up. Now, to give you a little bit of context, I was saved in the Southern Baptist Church when I was 15. Southern Baptist Church does not ordain women, among many other things. And so we were kind of talking about this, and I felt a sense of call in ministry, and somehow the question of women in ministry came up. And so I'm kind of theologizing in my little way, and all I hear is just dead silence on the other side. You know that's trouble, right? It's like, are you awake? Are you still there? And she says, well, my mother was a pastor. I was like, oh, shah. And she's like, so are you saying that my mother was going against God? I was like, no, that's not what I'm saying, but this is just the way that I... And I just like kept digging more and more and more and more. And so I should say this person is now my wife, so it all worked out okay. But the question though is, in that moment of difference, I know I was just speaking out of my own experience, right? This was the only church that I knew. When I was 15, God literally plucked me out of death and isolation, and that church was my life. And this life, this church that was my life, told me that this is what faithfulness looked like. That's all I had, right? But now, here I was confronted by not an idea, but by a person, a body, and the way that body had a story attached to it. And so in that encounter, in that moment of meeting a difference, I had to rethink. I was encountered with what the possibility of what her body meant, about what my body meant. And so the question is, well, what's true then? In the midst of all of these various encounters of difference, who is this God that I see in the world? What is Scripture even? And if this idea changes, does my understanding of God change? What does it mean for my sense of what is true and what's not true? And so we find ourselves in a unique moment in the history of the world. We have more exposure than ever to different ways that people see and understand the world, to the systems and structures that govern our communities, and to the vastly different ways that we experience these structures. We are confronted with identities that we have no categories for, oftentimes, and with people who are telling us that they not only see difference in the world, but we have to confront that difference. Sometimes they have to confront the difference in themselves, whether through social media, the increasing diversity of many communities, to news media, viral videos, the multiple platforms available to us to name and describe our particular experience in the world, all experiences that are grounded in what our bodies feel and taste and see, and the way that our bodies are seen and encountered, right? It's never just about who I say I am, but a kind of movement back and forth between who people say I am and who I say I am. Who people say I am not and who I say I am not. And this is, in a sense, is kind of the way that we negotiate identity over and over again. And so because of this, the differences that we encounter, I think, are outstripping the languages, the theologies, the educational systems, the cultural frameworks, our theologies even, that we have to describe these differences adequately. In the face of this seeming endless cacophony of difference, we might be tempted to resist, to retreat, to reach back for some semblance of tradition, a myth of America that allows us to figure out a way forward, a way to make sense of this world that we live within. But we must begin to do and live theology as if our bodies mattered. Christian identity must be confronted by and confess the word made flesh. The bodied word who is our life. In the face of splintering differences and violent normativities, we Christians do not have the luxury of shrinking away from encounters with difference, from pretending that those who are shouting out for life, for liberty, declaring Black Lives Matter, if we confess Christ must be encountered by a singular truth, the body matters to our lives and our identities as Christians. And the reason why this is so important is from the very beginning of creation, when God says, let us make them in our image, male and female, let us make them, and picks up some clay and joins it with eternal breath, we see that the material world is more than a weight to cut off so that our spirit can fly. In Israel's life, we see God joining God's self to a people and saying to them, I want to be known to you. I want to be known with you. I want to be known through you. I want to abide with you. Your identity will be bound to me, and I will be bound to you. And so if we are going to find some semblance of peace, some notion of a world that is just, where we might see one another more fully, we cannot avoid the question of difference. We must see difference as essential to Christian life. And to account for difference, we must account for our bodies, our lives as flesh and blood, as language and food and taste and sound and touch. But to see these, we must begin at the beginning. The God in whose image we live and breathe and have our being. At the heart of Christian confession is a God who is difference and likeness. We believe in one God. We believe in the Word. We believe in the Spirit. We believe in a God who is plural, who is multiple within God's own life and has always been this. At the same time, we believe this God is one of one substance, each person no more or less God than the other. Each of these person is like the other. Their identities are bound up in the identity of the other. The Father is not the Son. The Son is not the Father. The Father and the Son are not themselves without this thing we call the Spirit. They are different, but they are like. But in this likeness and difference of identity, we not only see a relationship, but we see relationality. What I mean by this is that this relationship does not simply exist, but it is dynamic. It moves, it wills, it loves. When we say that God is love, we do not mean that God is the definition of love. We say that God is love because God is the act of loving and being loved, of offering and receiving the other and the entirety of God's life. God's life is reciprocity. It is mutuality. And we say that God is true, but I wonder if we sometimes misinterpret this sense of truth through a lens of modernity that believes truth to be stable, certain, and predictable. What if truth is not a conceptual reality? It is a verb, not a noun, an activity, not a doctrine. Imagine the truth here is not a law of gravity, but it is the gravity itself. That when you jump, there is a physical, natural arrangement to this earth in this place that brings you back to the ground. It is not an idea that brings you back to the ground. It is a material reality that does this. And so when we say that God is truth, it is more accurate to say that God is true. The way that something thrown straight and with precision is true. The way that saying we say something rings true, because it resonates with our experience and what we intuit, perhaps. Or perhaps true is when you kick a ball and the ball finds that one sweet spot and you can feel all of the energy of your body flow completely into that little round thing. And even before you see where it goes, you know you hit it right. You hit it true. Something good has happened. But notice that in the truth of this moment, the truth is not in the that of each part. The leg, the foot, the ball, the truth of the moment is in the motion of each part coordinated and moving in a common purpose, even as they remain themselves. The ball is not the same thing as the foot, the instrument not the same thing as the player, your body not the same thing as the earth that you stand upon. And yet each of these things, when they are true, moving towards the other in concert, in truth, is covenantal, bound up together, a kind of synchronization of parts such that none of them can be understood apart from one another, and yet at the same time, they are all different. They are bodies, they are present, they are material. Now, the term covenant, I think, ties into this in some ways. It is both complexity and possibility. Tracing the invocation of covenantal language through Scripture reveals that God is perpetual presence and desire to be with humanity. Covenant is faithfulness that is reciprocated and mutual. And yet in Scripture, covenant is also paradoxical. It is irrevocable and constant, but it also cannot be completely known. Fundamentally, covenant is not simply about law, about what to do and what not to do. Covenant is about relationship, about how we are with God and with one another. Covenant is sometimes about who we are with. Sometimes it means exclusivity. Sometimes it means radical and scandalous inclusion. But these facts are never static. They seem to shift and slip along a deeper claim about what it means to be with God and for God to be with us. In Scripture, whenever the Jews who began to confess Jesus as Lord began to define the covenant around questions of what and who, God seemed to insert the troubling question of how into the image of what faithfulness could begin to look like. And so here we see the significance of our bodies in the midst of being made in the image of God. To be like God, our bodies are necessary, intrinsic to the task. We are covenanted people. Yes, our bodies are bound to one another, but whenever the Jews, whenever Christians begin to mistake who is in the room as truthfulness, as though our bodies are somehow the kind of an instantiation of the fullness of what makes something true, we lose a sense of what is true, right? Because it's not simply that we are in this room, but it's how we are in the room, how we are present to one another, how we allow these differences in one another to transform and draw us more deeply into God's purposes. Our bodies are this. We are made not simply to obey, but to play, to create, to live into a life with one another and to God. To be creatures who truly image God, our bodies are vital to the call. But bodies are curious things. They are not so singular in their purpose as instruments. They seem to shift in their possibilities in new ways. Our bodies are read. They speak. And these meanings shift over time. To discover how we live into the Imago Dei, we must also come to learn how our bodies speak. What strange new tongues we might utter in our lives together. But in order to learn this, we also have to learn how our bodies have spoken. What are the histories that are attached to them? So such that when you enter into a room, you have to ask yourself, what is the work that my body is doing? How am I communicating? How are people reading me? And then how do I read others? When we begin to see this, we begin to see the differences that permeate our lives together and what it is that God might do in the midst of them. And so in the midst of a world fractured by proliferating difference, if we try to judge the truth of these differences by a measurement that is static, that is grounded in a kind of ontology of truth. Ontology is this kind of fancy word that means kind of the essence of who we are, the essence of something. Right, the essence of a true, that has no movement, we will be missing one of the central claims of Christian and Jewish faith, that God moves. Now, I am not suggesting that laws or rules are relativistic. What I am saying is that if we are going to live into the deepest rhythms of God's faithfulness, we must account for the rhythm, that not simply the rhythm and not simply the notes. God's truth is a movement of life, a being with wherein we are caught not only with God, but also with one another. And that binding throws us into the lives of others. The truth of God is not a dogma or a rule or what. It is a how. And when we begin to see the necessity of the who and the how, we begin to see the deepest possibilities of a bodied life, a life with one another and towards one another that is not without a rule of life, but neither is that rule idolatrous. We see the hope of difference woven into the very creation of existence. God's self-difference and likeness. God separates day and night, ground from water, plant from earth, creature from sea, then land and air. In everything that exists, there is difference. It is difference down to our very atoms. And yet this difference is not static. It is vibration. It is a song. It is movement. In every difference that we encounter is an opportunity to hear the song again, to see it in a new way, to see how deep it goes, to see how this movement shifts and flips under our feet. So when I was encountered by my then girlfriend's story, I had a choice. I could resist. I could cover. I could run away. I could cut it out. I could forget it in order to remain and maintain this sense of truth that had helped me to make sense of the world. Or I could listen. I could walk with her. I could hear how God's story was ringing in her life, in the life of her mother. And what that means is that my life would be different. My body would somehow have to sing in a different way. I know now that I am freer because I encountered her. I know my understanding of God is more profound, has new facets, because I allowed that encounter to break me free from the illusion that somehow my man parts made my words worth listening to. Because of this, I hear the true in more vibrant colors. The hope of difference is not that we are different and therefore can appreciate one another. The hope is not that we are different and so we are all the same and so therefore we can ignore one another's difference. The hope of difference, the hope of our bodied lives, is that we are not true without the movement of love between us. The hope of difference is not simply in skin color or class or gender or sexuality or ability, but it lies in the possibilities of what those differences are and what we can all become when they are played together in those moments of contact, of spaces of hearing and being heard. We discover the fullest possibilities of what it means to bear the image of God. But let me be clear about this. This is dangerous work. When we truly allow ourselves to be encountered by these bodies that are different, by the stories that they inhabit, we risk ourselves becoming something different. We risk being encountered by the stories of our bodies that we don't want to tell, that we don't want to face. Like Peter, like Paul, like those other early Jews who followed Jesus and were so certain that his body meant the certainty and the power and the establishment of their bodies. They were gonna rule, things were gonna get flipped, things were gonna change, they were gonna be on top, right? And then what did Jesus do but drew all of their bodies into the house of that tax collector? That man who they thought was antithetical to who they were as Jews. And now what did Jesus say? Is that your Jewish body has to be understood next to his Jewish body. Your Jewish body has to be understood next to that Syrophoenician's non-Jewish body. And for some like Peter, they didn't understand their Jewishness as long as there was a Gentile next to it. So when we really encounter one another's stories, our tastes, our histories, we risk something. We risk becoming, in a sense, confused, open. We have to change our story somehow. God is dynamic. God moves. Our bodies are covenantal, which means it is not that they are, it is how they are and with whom they are. And this begins not with an idea, but with hands and feet and sound and taste. It begins with our lives being heard and honored and listened to. It means bending ourselves into a truth that our in our intricacies and our differences, we all become rhythm and song. And in order to do this, our differences cannot be covered over, but must be illuminated, must speak with holy fire, and they must be heard and given room to ring. Thank you. So I believe we have some time for questions. So we have two microphones. Feel free to.
I've been a member here for a long time. I think all of our ears kind of perked up when you dropped the word covenant. I don't know if you're familiar with our church covenant, but this is something we struggled with over a period of time and adopted and have kept with certain very important changes on one occasion to it. But this has been something that I think a lot of people have said, oh, well, that's, I'll go along with that, and have in their introduction to the church, this has meant a lot to them. I continue to struggle with my separateness, and I think this is something that all of us do. I think that each of us is unique, and that tends to present some barriers to acceptance to others and to the message of others. But we appreciate so much what you've had to say, which I think helps enlighten us in our struggle as we're moving down the road here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Bantam, thank you for being here today, and that was a very interesting message you had, and I'm curious about one thing you said, if I understood it correctly, and that is that being a Christian involves risk-taking, and did I hear you correctly in saying it also involves living with confusion? Mm-hmm. And that's a hard message to follow as a Christian. I think all of us are seeking certainty in our lives and in our religion. And to hear that it's really a more a different shape than what we might have thought, and that it involves living with confusion. Could you speak to that a little bit more?
Yeah. I mean, I think the more, I mean, there's a funny way that we tend to tame scripture. We're amazing scripture tamers, right? And I think that as human beings, we want a kind of certainty. Like I'm a creature of habit. So like I traveled here and I have a kind of rhythm. I get myself a pack of Mentos. I bring myself a little empty water bottle. I put it up here. I get myself all set up in my plane. And that's what I do every single time. And God forbid that there are no Mentos to be found. I'm like, what do I do? And so even if something as small as traveling, I'm looking for a sense of order, right? How much bigger do I look for order when I'm trying to think about the meaning of my life, right? The meaning of my existence. And I think we could track this back to the Old Testament as well, but even just in the New Testament, if we think about the way that what is it that Jesus led his followers into was not a life of certainty. At every single turn, as soon as Peter, I mean, I love me some Peter. Every time Peter thought he got it, like, okay, this is, now we got it. And Jesus is like, then Jesus like just, and notice like Jesus doesn't tell him, Peter, you're wrong. What Jesus does is introduce him to a different body, right? Oh, now you have it. Okay, that's good. We're down. Okay, now guess what? We're going to go to this person's house. What? But we're Jews. Yeah, you're still a Jew. But now your Jewishness has to be understood as bound to this Gentile. But what then does your Jewishness look like? And Peter's like, okay, fine, right? And then we move on. And then now Jesus said, look, I'm gonna, you got to wash my feet. He's like, oh, what? That doesn't make any sense, right? Now Jesus says I'm going to go get taken. Peter pulls out his sword. So at every single moment, Peter is always and I love this idea of rock, right? Because he's always trying to find stability. He's always trying to be this, let's do something that we can build from. And every time Jesus takes that rock, he smashes it over and over and over again. And part of what I love about this work around the body, and the reason why so much of my work centers around this, comes from my own particular story as a Black mixed race man, whose body is never really quite has a place. Now I've been deeply gifted and gratified for the Black community to find. They say you have a home with us. You're part of who I am. But I also know that my story has these other facets, these other layers. So what it means is that my life is always a little confused. I'm a little racially ambiguous. And so people don't quite know what to do with me when I roll up into is he this? Is he that? And so that gives me just enough space to introduce myself. But at the same time, I have to navigate those spaces. My body does work. My body, in a sense, is always functioning in these confused spaces. So in some ways, that idea of confusion makes perfect sense to me because I live in that space. But I can imagine it is a frightening idea when one's body gives them an illusion of certainty, an illusion of home, that the rhythms and patterns that we live, everyone has their proverbial mentos, right? Everybody has those things that they kind of depend on. And then all of a sudden, you encounter someone who's different. And then that's the question. And that's kind of the question I want to push here is if when our Christian faith has so easily dismissed confusion as part of what it means to follow, it becomes so much easier to refuse the body that's different because we want to protect ourselves. But what if at the very heart of it is actually confusion, a holy, blessed confusion? And a confusion not so much that we don't know, but I'm thinking here a kind of Pentecostal confusion, where we speak with new tongues and somehow our bodies and our lives can be heard by others. And we can hear the stories and the promises of God in the lives of others who we thought were always outside of the promises of God. And yet somehow their lives exhibit a faithfulness, a covenantedness, a love, that maybe perhaps God is trying to infuse into us. But in order to do that, our sense of certainty has to be muddled, has to be fragmented a little bit. We need to be confused in order to hear the true, maybe.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for your presence today and comments. I share your love of North Carolina and never lived in Seattle in the Northwest, but love that anytime I visit, there's something about the salt air, but also the freshness of experience. But the presence of in the Northwest there, technology is a huge presence that the rest of the country only experiences in a different way. So you may have ingrained opinions developed. And my question is about technology and the body and the fact that we're now sort of interconnected around the world by this technology world, and yet you don't see the body of the other person anymore in the same way that you do in a personal presence, in interaction. And so I just wondered if you had kind of developed thoughts about the changing life that we're in, where you have more, personal presence, which the body language is so impactful, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so, that's a great question. I think there's a couple things. I think one, on the one hand, yes, we don't we don't necessarily sit in a room with people across the way as much. And there's sometimes something about sitting in the room with someone that allows a kind of intimacy, a kind of slowness to receive the other. At the same time, though, I think technology is really amazing because it allows people to tell their stories in such amazing ways. And given the fact that so much of our lives are actually still very much segregated, right? We might meet people, but how many different people are you really going to meet on a day-to-day basis? But what technology actually allows, and it's amazing that especially younger folks, they allow people into their lives. There's a kind of intimacy that's possible. Now the question then, but that creates another kind of layer, because on the one hand, you haven't seen their body in the room, right? But they've given you access to the experience of their body in the world. And so what that means is that we actually have to it requires a little bit more discipline to see them as a person, to see their story and their life, and not judge and not allow the distance to be an ease of judgment, right? So what happens is everything becomes that slope becomes real sharp. And so it takes a lot more discipline to say, as I'm reading this blog or listening to a podcast, following someone's Instagram, what does it mean to simply receive whatever it is that they're offering? Not as the totality of who they are, but a piece of who they are. And so in that way, I think it allows for both the deeper connectedness, but also I think heightens what has always been a temptation, right? Which is to reduce someone to something that we can see. And I think we do a pretty good job of that in person as well as in through technology. But yeah, so I think it heightens the need to have that discipline and that approach for sure.
Hi, I was very captured by the things you were saying around the nature of truth, as if I understood you to say that truth is not a static thing, mm-hmm. truth is a dynamic thing, and it got me thinking about how that really rings true for me, and the nature of reality and how it really shifts over time, or maybe new facets are revealed, you know, maybe mm-hmm. they were always there, but I didn't perceive. So could you talk a little more around that, about truth?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think in some ways we think of, let's take something, for example, like what it means to be made in the image of God. And God says, let's make them in our image, let's make them male and female. And then God makes Adam, or some people like kind of the first earth creature. And I always like to make fun of patriarchal kind of figure readings of this, because people make a big deal out of men being first and blah 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 in certain traditions. But notice like Adam's actually the first thing that's not good. God makes everything else light, dark, like good. Adam, needs work. Of course, like what is it that, I mean, Adam intrinsically isn't bad, but what is it about Adam that's not good is that he doesn't have another, right? So the way that I sometimes write about this is I say in a sense, image of God is a word that's spoken. Adam is just the first syllable, right? And so Eve is the completion of the word image of God, right? And so what does this mean? It comes back to this idea of the true. Adam isn't true. Like the image of God in Adam is not a truth that is kind of intrinsic in his kind of static being. His image of God is only true when he has to share a life with another who is of the same stuff, who is like him, but who is not him, right? In the same way that this other who is with him has to choose him. And so then all of a sudden, you say, well, like, if anybody's ever tried to, like, you know, maybe everybody decides, at least in our family, Friday nights are always fun because it's our fun eat out night. And there's five people in our family. I have three. So I have a 20-year-old, an 18-year-old, and a 14-year-old. And we all like, okay, what are we going to eat? And everyone just looks at each other because there's five different ideas in the house, right? Well, you're like, okay, what's going on here? Well, part of it is like we all have to like, okay, what is this person really like? And that person had a hard week. And like, and so as we're kind of starting to figure out how to navigate all of these different tastes, there is a true that emerges. Because as we listen to one another, as we bend towards one another, as I give up my burger for my wife's sushi, right? There is a kind of true that emerges that's not static in each of our bodies, but in the ways in which we bend towards one another. That's the true, right? In the same way that I think about an instrument, so you take something like a piano, right? Its piano-ness is strings and wood and metal, right? But its true is when you hit a key, right? And the key strikes the string, right? And then there's a sound that happens. And so there's this reverberation that's happening. There's a kind of movement that's always happening. And so I think that as we begin to think about what does Christian truth mean, I think that we have to ask ourselves, what is the true? What are those rhythms? What are those patterns of truthfulness that God is calling us to? And I think in essence, this is what Jesus's life was, right? You have heard it said, but now I say unto you. He's not getting rid of it, right? But he's saying you've made the truth static. You've made the law an idol, right? And in doing so, you've rendered people as mere bodies to make your holiness intelligible. So what is the truth? The truth is a way of welcoming that person into your life. And I think that's that sense.
I'm enjoying your choice of words. They're beautiful and right on. And my favorite is illuminate the differences, because that just helps with confusion, which I'm often confused, and with multiple choices, and with the mixture and the richness of covenant with each other, of understanding each other, in facing the differences and learning from each other. And that's such a rich part of life. And so I thank you very much for your choice of words.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you so much for your thoughts about the dynamic nature of truth. And it made me kind of think about quantum physics, like you can have the property of a particle and a wave, kind of. I was wondering if you would have thoughts about the idea of racism and how deep it runs in our country. I've been reading a book called Stamped from the Beginning, and it's about how it just is the water we swim in America and Western civilization. So would you be able to reflect on applying your thoughts about truth and racism and kind of practical matters of what we should do?
Yeah. Well, in fact, in my book, Death of Race. So I think in a lot of ways, no, I think you're absolutely right, and I really appreciate the kind of connection that you're making there. I mean, in essence, if we want to think about this idea of identity and truth, right, who we are is established by who we're not, right? And in a sense, that's the story of America. The story of America is the creation of a particular people through the kind of perpetual myth making of what other bodies are in relationship to whiteness, right? So part of it to say, like, so in a sense, we can't talk about race really without talking about whiteness. Whiteness is itself a kind of construction. It is a myth that's only made intelligible by putting these other bodies next to it. And in essence, what it's done and what's so powerful about it is it creates its own truth, right? Because what is it does? Because in the midst of creating that truth about white bodies, it does things like segregate housing, right? Strips away, gives scholarships to some people when they come back from the war, white folk when they come back from the war, and doesn't give scholarships to black people. It gives homeowner loans, right? So in a way, so what ends up happening is the truth becomes instantiated in these laws, policies, which then themselves perpetuate a certain way of framing, and it makes it difficult to see one another. So I think part of what we want to, what part of what the beauty of the church is, and I think part of what this idea of thinking about the true, is that if we call ourselves Christians, if we call ourselves disciples, it means that we have to allow ourselves to be faced by the lie of what racism has said about what our bodies mean. That somehow our lives are the consequence of a series of decisions that are just mine or my parents or my hard work, right? And actually begin to see the way in which there is a truth in this country that that in a sense rings in ways that are much bigger than me. And so then the question becomes, well, as Christians, what are the ways that we can begin to resist that? Well, it means we begin finding different people's stories as part of our story. That's why I love the fact that you mentioned Stamped from the Beginning, because what then ask ourselves to do is, wait a second, the Stamped from the Beginning is not just the story about the names of the ways in which racism has affected Black people. It is also the story of the of what white people have said, right? And so then we have to ask ourselves, how do I see this way of telling the story in my own life? In elections, in local politics, in school funding, in all these kind of small ways that we might kind of be drawn into a lie. One other thing I might say about this is that I think part of the lie of white supremacy is the lie of self-sufficiency, the lie of self-determination, the lie of independence. And I think in a way what that does is it perpetuates the notion of truth, right, that becomes radically individualized. And then, but then we kind of put this veneer, this armor of God's truth around it so that we don't have to be affected by it, right? But what happens if we enter into a Christian story that says that I'm not me without you, right? And that my body is a complicated story that I have to, and I have to learn how that body does work. Hope that was helpful.
Thank you. Wow, I'm surprised that your kids are that old, first of all.
Thank you.
That's what I was going to ask you, is how do you navigate or help them navigate? Because you're so passionate about this, obviously, that surely they are subjected to your passion. And I just wonder now, they're teenagers, how they have navigated. How, you know, what tools did you give them to grow up?
I always try to drop my kids' age as kind of a little barometer to see how my looks are coming. Because so I'll say, like, I have a 20-year-old, and people still say, oh, I'm like, yeah, I still got it. I'm a little worried about that day when I say, like, oh, he's so, and then people are like, yeah, that sounds about right. I'm like, oh. No, but thank you for the question. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, I mean, this idea of the true is very much, I think, I mean, I don't think my wife and I, we didn't set out to kind of live our lives this way, but I think it's one of those things that we've discovered over time. We discovered with our kids really early on, the more that we talk to them about something, the less likely they are to listen to us. And so especially, you know, poor them, they have a theologian as a father, a pastor as a mother. And so we tried the Bible study devotional thing when they were little, and it always devolved into, sit down, we're trying to study the Word of God here. And we're like, okay, this is not the feeling of faithfulness that we want them to have. So what we realized really early on was that, and what became really scary was that we realized that they were learning from us, but they were learning from what we did every single day and the things that we talked about. And we talk about all kinds of stuff. Some things are really helpful. Some things are maybe less than helpful. And so once we started to kind of realize, oh, wait a second, they're watching. Like their formation is not actually in our words, the truth that we tell them, right? Our formation, our parenting of them is in the truthfulness in which we live, which is actually really scary, right? Because it's much easier to come up with a true saying, right, than to live a true life. And so that's the first thing, is we kind of realized, okay, the things that Gail and I talk about, they become part of the air. The places that we go, the ways that we spend our time, the things that we are really passionate about and the things that we are frustrated about, those are all formation. And at the same time, all of our kids are individuals. They're their own people. My wife is Korean American, so they're Korean, Black, and White. And so their communities are complicated. And so they're not always read as Korean. They're not always read as Black. And yet they feel themselves inside of these communities. Sometimes they feel themselves alienated from these communities. And so it was never an easy question. So that's kind of the second part of it. The first part is we try to live as truthful a life as we can. We try to admit when we don't know. We admit when we've made mistakes. We're trying to grow as much as we can. But we also try to enjoy the things that we have. But then the second part of it is that we also give them room to discover what their bodies mean in the midst of all this, what their faith means in the midst of all this. So because of this, it was really important for us to be a part of a church that gave them a kind of image of Christian kinship and family. We go to a church that is multi-ethnic, that's devoted to questions of justice, that talks about those things in addition to a kind of rich spiritual life. And so that was the water we wanted to kind of stick them in. And I've actually been really amazed that over time, you know, at first they don't want anything to do with anything. But then over time, you know, it's, you know, if you all have, anybody has teenagers, you know, it will like, it's about 11:30, I'm getting ready to go to bed. And all of a sudden my 17-year-old plops himself down in the chair next to me. And that's when he wants to talk about all the deep questions. And I'm like, I got an 8 o'clock class, man. But I was like, oh, it's happening now. Okay, let's get ready. Right? And then it goes 6 months and like, it's nothing, everything else. And so it's recognizing that they are asking these questions. They're gonna ask these questions because they are themselves bodies in a world and they're getting confronted by these differences. Their bodies themselves are getting read, and the questions kind of come and go in different ways. And so giving space for those questions to emerge and for them to ask them on their own ways, and then creating a safe space for them where they can come to us with those questions, with those complaints, with the worries. And I think at the end of the day, then hopefully sending them out. One of the things that I do, this kind of work about, I call it a mulatto theology or a mulatic theology. And one of the kind of underlying kind of ideas there is that for me, a Christian tradition cannot be about these particular marks. What I mean by this is that it is a rhythm, it is a pattern. That for my kids, I can't give them the upbringing that I had. It's impossible. They don't have a Black father, they don't have a white mother in a predominantly white neighborhood. It's not their existence, right? And at the same time, there is a kind of rhythm of faithfulness that's possible in navigating those things, but I can't determine it for them. They have to live into it. They have to discover it in some senses. But I hope that our life gives them a ring of the true, so that when they go out into the world, they also hear, they can hear falsity, they can hear hollowness, they can hear rigidity, they can hear when something's trying to stamp out their song. And so then they gravitate then to something that's true. That's the hope.